The Bad Christian, or Sermons on the Seven Deadly Sins and the Different Sins Against God and Our Neighbor Which Flow Therefrom, by Father Francis Hunault, translated from the original German edition of Cologne, 1740, by Father J. Allen, Imprimatur, Bishop James D. Ricard, copyright 1887. On the shameful malice of those who impoverish themselves and injure their good name by excessive drinking, preached on the fourth Sunday in Lent. Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? St. John chapter 6, verse 5. Poor people, who were reduced to such extremities that they were hungry and had not bread to eat, as we read of the crowd in today's gospel. And yet it was their zeal in following Christ in order to hear his word that brought them to such a pass. We buy bread that these may eat, not through zeal in following Christ, but through a willful desire of satisfying their inordinate appetites, through which they and their families must often suffer the pangs of hunger. Certainly, God will not work a miracle to help such people. I allude to those inveterate drunkards who drink until they reduce themselves and those belonging to them to beggary. Last Sunday, I spoke of the folly of drinking so as to injure the health. Today, I will speak of the second evil effect of drunkenness, and I say, there are many who drink more than their incomes allow. What folly and wickedness! Such will be the first part, to which I shall briefly add the third evil effect, namely, that many drink more than is good for their honor and reputation. What a shame and disgrace! Such will be the second part. My object is to deter all decent people who are here present from this abominable habit. Strengthen my words to this effect, O Lord, and give us all thy light and grace through the intercession of Mary, thy mother, and her holy angel's guardian. The first point may be applied to all, even women, who ruin their families by idleness, luxury in dress, and other superfluities, and also to parents who bring up their daughters in idleness and do not teach them housekeeping, so that when the latter get married, they are unable to look after their domestic affairs through want of experience, and thus cause their families much harm and do a great deal of injury besides. It is a well-known fact that an industrious and diligent father of a family, who lives decently according to his condition, but practices due economy, can save a great deal and support himself and those who depend on him with very little expense. It is quite the contrary with inveterate drunkards and those who spend their time in idleness. They squander away all they have until they are not able to meet their household expenses and have to be satisfied with very poor fare in the end. There is no proof required to show the truth of this. Be not in the feast of great drinkers, says the Holy Ghost in the book of Proverbs, nor in their revelings who contribute flesh to eat, because they that give themselves to drinking and that club together shall be consumed, and drowsiness shall be clothed with rags. And again in the 21st chapter, he that loveth good cheer shall be in want, he that loveth wine and fat things shall not be rich. The reason of this is clear and patent to all, for he who drinks frequently and copiously must often put out his purse, as he cannot expect the wine to flow into his house for nothing. Or, if he has a vineyard of his own, he still consumes money's worth, and so makes away with his property as if he were a sieve, which lets out all the more is poured into it. Besides, a drunkard can never repair his losses, because even if he got his drink for nothing. He makes himself incapable of attending to his business by which he has to support himself and his family. No matter how successful a shoekeeper is in business, if he once gets fond of drink, then goodbye to his prosperity. He will not keep his books properly. His customers will begin to desert him. His clerks will have it all their own way. He will neglect to push his business and will lose his credit. In a word, he will not be long in ruining himself. How can an official or a lawyer attend properly the cases entrusted to him if his brains are always muddled with wine? And who would give an important case to such a man? Oh, no, people would say, I am not going to leave myself in the hands of a drunkard like that. No one would even venture to ask his advice or to instruct him with a secret. For according to the proverb, when the wine is in, the wit is out. What can a laborer do to support himself and his family if he is addicted to drink? The work is neglected, the fields are untilled, the last penny is spent for drink, and his house is falling to pieces for want of repairs. In a word, as St. John Chrysostom says, the drunkard is unfit for any kind of business. He is good for nothing but drinking and spending money. What can this lead to but ruin? No matter how great a treasure is, if there is something taken out of it every day and nothing added to it, it must soon be exhausted. The worst of this wretched vice is that the more one indulges in it, the more inveterate the habit becomes, and the stronger the desire for drink. There are many other ways of being extravagant and of spending money, such as dressing too expensively, having showy and costly furniture, giving unnecessary entertainments, spending one's time in gaming, idleness, etc. All these things bring nothing in, and make away with a great deal. Still, it is not difficult to remedy the mischief they cause in that way. One can be more economical in dress, more cautious of gambling, more sparing of entertainments, more diligent in looking after one's domestic concerns. But when a man has once become addicted to the wretched vice of drunkenness, his cure is almost hopeless. His carousing overnight makes him thirsty again in the morning, because it affects the liver and the stomach, and he is like one who has swallowed seawater, which increases instead of taking away thirst, as the Holy Ghost says in the book of Proverbs. Look not upon the wine when it is yellow, when the color thereof shineth in the glass. Thou shalt be as one sleeping in the midst of the sea, and thou shalt say, when shall I awake and find wine again? This is the case even with those women who indulge too much in dainties and hot drinks. The next morning they feel quite unwell, and their first thought is for the teapot, although they have not yet made their morning offering or the sign of the cross, or said their prayers. So great is their hurry to get something to drink. Thus, the desire for drink is preferred not merely to one's household duties, but even to God Himself. And as one day ends in drinking, the following day is commenced in the same way. Thus, the desire for drink is preferred not merely to one's household duties, but even to God Himself. And as one day ends in drinking, the following day is commenced in the same way. Have you ever seen a dog, says Seneca, standing by while his master is eating? His mouth waters, and his eyes are always fixed on his master. If the latter throws him a bit of bread, He snaps at it and swallows it down in a moment, and just as greedily as before, he stands there waiting for another bite. The same thing, continues the philosopher, occurs with the drunkard. He is never satisfied. What he drinks today lasts only until he has slept it off, and when he has done so, he longs for more. Thus, one fit of drunkenness succeeds another, so that it is impossible to find him sober except in the forenoon or early in the morning. What, I ask again, can be the result of that but extravagance, ruin, and poverty, which will eventually compel the drunkard to give up his bad habit for want of means? Diogenes once saw an acquaintance of his, who had formerly been in good circumstances, but had brought himself to poverty by hard drinking, sitting at a table in an inn and eating a few dried olives. Oh, he said, if you had always dined like that, you would not now have to be content with such a poor supper. On another occasion, he passed by an empty house that was offered for sale. Ah, said he, I knew long ago that this house, being always full of wine, would soon vomit forth its owner. The saying, this man has been plucked by wine, derives its origin from an Athenian who spent all he had in drink, so that at last he was forced to go half naked. Oh, how many there are nowadays who deserve the same reproach, who from masters have become servants and beggars from rich men. How many sons there are who inherited a rich property from their thrifty parents, and who now have to go about in rags like a prodigal son. To give instances of this in order to prove that there are such people would be like opening the graves in order to show that people die. Of all such people, we may say with truth that they are plucked by wine, for drunkenness has brought them to poverty. What madness it is, says St. Augustine, to pour down one's throat in a day, where would suffice to supply one decently with food and drink for 3 or 4 days, and to exhaust in a few years by excessive drinking what could have supported one's self and family for a whole lifetime. And here I must express my heartfelt pity for those citizens and workmen who have a wife and family to support, and have no other means of doing so but their daily labor, but who, being given to drink, send the few pence they earn to the public house and generally drink in one Sunday all they have earned for the week. As St. Ambrose says, they drink in one day the labor and sweat of many days. Meanwhile, they have hardly a decent coat on their backs or bread and water enough to keep body and soul together during the week. And when they come to old age, or sickness comes on, so that they are unable to work, they have not a penny in their pockets to buy a piece of bread for themselves and their families. But far greater is my pity for the unfortunate wives and families who are brought to extreme poverty by those drunken men, and who have to suffer hunger and thirst at home, while those who should provide for them are swilling wine or beer in the tavern, thus verifying the words of St. Paul to the Corinthians. Then one indeed is hungry, and another is drunk. What a crying injustice that is! They to whom God has entrusted a wife and children to be supported as well as possible according to their condition are the very ones who make away with what belongs to their wives and children, and reduce them to beggary. And unfortunately, that is of only too common occurrence. It is a sin of injustice to steal even the least thing from a rich man who would not miss it, What a fearful sin it must be for the father thus to rob his own children, whom he has begotten, and his wife, with whom he should be one body and one soul. There the Christians were horrified at the cruelty of the pagans, who used to sacrifice their own children at their feasts and drink their blood out of goblets. An enormity of that kind is most revolting to our nature. But you, drunken Christians, act far more cruelly to your children. You have found a way of gnawing at your children's flesh and drinking their blood, not only without horror and disgust, but actually with joy and pleasure, when you spend in drinking and carousing what should be devoted to their support. Do not think that I am saying too much or speaking too severely. It is the Holy Ghost who uses the same expressions and calls those unnatural fathers murderers of their own children. Merciless murderers of their own children, and eaters of men's bowels, and devourers of blood. Cruel fathers, if you gave to the poor the money that is necessary for the decent support of your wives and children, you would commit a grievous sin against charity and justice, which bind you to provide for them before you give anything even to Christ himself in the persons of the poor. But you spend in sinful excess, in drinking and carousing, that which should go to support and clothe and educate your families. What wickedness that is! Even if temporal poverty and distress were the only evils you cause, it would not matter so much. But your cruelty goes farther than that. You bring eternal death on your families and occasion the loss of their souls, a not unfrequent result of your drinking excesses. I do not speak now of the scandal you give when you come home in the state of intoxication and curse and swear and ill-treat your wives and children, nor of the sins into which your children are led by your neglecting to give them a proper Christian training. I speak only of the contempt that they must feel for you, although they are bound to honor you, of the hatred they must have for you, although they are bound to love you, of the curses they call down on your heads, although they ought to pray for you, of the little care they will take of you when they have succeeded in raising themselves by their diligence out of the poverty into which they were plunged by your drunkenness and intemperance. For how could they have any affection for a father who has shown so little love and tenderness to his own flesh and blood? How can they act as children to him who has not been as a father to them? How can they acknowledge their obligation to support and help him who by his drunkenness has left them nothing but poverty and misery as their portion? Nor do I speak of any terrible sins, such as despair, to which they are often driven by the poverty caused through your intemperance. Father Ambrose Cantinaeus relates a terrible example of this. There was once a poor young woman who had three children, two of whom were just able to walk, while the third was still in the cradle. She had nothing for them to eat, because her husband used to spend all his earnings in drink. The poor woman, driven to extremity, ventured once into the tavern where her husband was, and falling down on her knees, said to him, "Oh, my dear husband, I beg of you to take pity on us. Your children and I have not eaten anything for 2 days, and we are dying of hunger." Her husband, already half intoxicated, grew furious at being thus addressed and drove his wife away. The poor woman was in a worse state than before. When she reached home, her children ran out to meet her, thinking she had brought them something to eat. They caught hold of her apron and felt her pockets, but they found nothing. The poor woman was heartbroken at the sight. She knew not what to do, until at last, unable to bear the sight of their misery any longer, she took a knife and cut the throats of her three children. In the same state of desperation, she awaited the arrival of her husband, who, as usual, came home drunk and cut his throat too during his sleep. The straits to which she was reduced might well have excused her desperate act. Still, she was arrested and condemned to death according to law. She heard her sentence pronounced with the greatest composure, and when she arrived at the place of execution, she spoke so forcibly against those husbands who indulge in excessive drinking that there was a remarkable improvement noticed afterwards amongst the people in that respect. Ah, would that my words, too, had power to wean drunkards from their evil ways! I trust I have no drunkards before me now, but in case any such are here present, who are not deterred from their evil habit by fear of losing their health or their money, I ask them at least not to drink more than is good for their honor and reputation, which are seriously injured by excessive drinking, as we shall see in the second part. Honor and life are generally looked upon as of the same value. Nay, many a one values his good name more than his life, so that he is ready to expose the latter to 1,000 dangers for the sake of preserving or gaining the former. Many heathens have deliberately sacrificed, nay, taken away their lives, that their names might descend to prosperity untarnished. No one, unless he is the most degraded of men, will allow the least stain to affect his honor. And yet, this honor is utterly ruined by excessive drinking, for what is more disgraceful than to have the name of being a drunkard? What more loathsome object is there than a drunken man? St. Gregory Nazianzen says that there was once a beautiful girl who used to amuse herself by playing on the flute. But one day, happening to catch the reflection of her face in a pond of clear water, and seeing how it was disfigured by the flute, she became so disgusted with that instrument that she gave it up altogether. I think, my dear brethren, that if one who is created to the image and likeness of God, and who therefore is made only for heavenly things, could see himself and the actions he does when in a state of intoxication, clearly reflected in a mirror, he would be ashamed of himself, and if he had a spark of honorable feeling left, would give up drinking at once. Anacharsis, being asked the best means of practicing temperance, replied that it was to see how people act who are intoxicated. It was in that way that the Lacedaemonians tried to deter their children from drunkenness. They used to make a slave drunk and let him go staggering about in that condition in presence of their children, so that the latter, seeing how unbecomingly he acted and how unworthy of a reasoning being, might have a horror and dread of excessive drinking. And, in fact, if one who knew nothing of this vice were suddenly to see a drunken man, he would take him for a wild beast, or at least for a madman. And, after all, what difference is there between a drunken man and a madman, unless that the latter was involuntarily deprived of the use of reason, while the former deliberately deprives himself of it? St. Basil compares them to dumb idols. What else are drunken men but idols such as the heathens adore? They have eyes and see not, they have ears and hear not, hands and feel not, feet and walk cannot walk, tongues and cannot speak. I see men as it were trees walking, said the blind man, when Christ first restored his sight, and he was enabled to distinguish objects faintly. If he had seen a drunken man, even after his sight was fully restored, I think he would have made the same remark. I see men, as it were, trees walking. I see them swaying from side to side, like trees in a storm, as if they could not keep their feet. They stagger about and fall down almost as often as they get up. They are a nuisance to all the decent people, and object of scorn and ridicule to their own friends, children, and servants. St. John Chrysostom says that a drunkard is a disgrace to humanity. And what greater shame can there be than to degrade human nature from its dignity? Man is created to the image and likeness of God. He is only a little inferior to the angels and princes of heaven in dignity. Thou hast made him a little less than the angels, says the psalmist. But when he is drunk, what becomes of the dignity of his nature? What trace of the divine image can be discerned in him? He is, so to speak, no longer a man. He is not a whit better than a beast. As St. Basil says, drunkenness turns a man into a beast. For while he is in that condition, how can he be distinguished from a beast? By his eyes, ears, hands, or feet? But wild beasts have these too, and they make a far better use of them than a drunken man does. It is reason alone, by which we think and judge and discern, that raises our nature almost immeasurably above that of the brute creation. If we lose our reason, as is the case with the drunkard, we are no better than the beasts. Nay, one could wish that the drunkard were as good. How much better, says St. Chrysostom, is an ass or a dog than a drunken man? And why? Because those animals will not drink more than is necessary to slack their thirst. You may beat an ass as long as you please. Once he has had enough, he will not drink a drop more. You, therefore, O drunkards, are worse than beasts, for you drink 6 times, 10 times more than your necessity requires, or your means allow. What a shame and disgrace to an honorable name. That is true, they will say, but the vice is so common nowadays that there is no disgrace in it. We're all in the one boat. They even make a boast of it, and think it a fine thing to be drunk. Alas, that the wickedness of the world should go so far as to make a boast of a vice that is condemned by God and by nature, and abhorred by unreasoning animals, and that even Christians should not hesitate to boast of it. It may easily happen that a respectable man, once or twice in company, gets a little overcome by drink, on account of bodily weakness, or because he is off his guard. He does not thereby disgrace himself. He rather deserves to be pitied. But I am not speaking of such cases as that. I speak only of those who are habitual drunkards, and who are seldom to be seen sober. There is no respectable man who will tell me that there are men of honor and worthy of esteem, and there is no one who will deny that all decent people look on them as disgraced. No matter how pious, how learned, how clever, how experienced a man is, if he once gets the name of being a drunkard, all his good qualities are of no use to him. He sinks at once in the estimation of every one. Thus we often hear people say in a pitying tone, such a one is a good man, but unfortunately he is too fond of drink. What a pity it is! If it were not for that, he would be one of the best fellows in the world, and so on. when the Pharisees failed to find any other accusation against our Lord, they said that he was a drunkard, in spite of his perfect sobriety and temperance. When they saw him at the marriage feast at Cana, at the house of Martha and Bethania, with Matthew and Zacchaeus, who were public sinners, with the rich Pharisee and many others, they took occasion from his presence at those feasts to try and ruin his character. "Behold," said they, "this man is a glutton and a wine drinker." This false accusation of theirs was the means they made use of to lessen at least his reputation, if they could not take it away altogether. Therefore, he who is habitually addicted to intemperance cannot be esteemed by anyone, except perhaps by the companions of his carousals, and that is an esteem such as thieves have for the most daring and lawless of their gang. Although the judgments of the world are mostly vain and false, yet there is no one of common sense who does not at once condemn and look down upon him who has the reputation of being a drunkard. A drunkard, I have said, that is, a drunken man, for I do not dare to suggest even the possibility of that vice being found amongst women. A drunken woman? What a horrible thing even to imagine. There is nothing so disgraceful as a woman as to say that she is given to drink. For if she is addicted to that vice, what is to become of her household duties, of the education of her children, and of the necessary watchfulness over her servants? How can the mistress of a family perform those duties if she is given to intemperance? Everyone sees at once, without further proof, that under the circumstances, the ruin of the family is certain, and hence, amongst many nations, it was the custom to interdict the use of wine to women under the severest penalties. The ancient Romans punished a woman who had drunk but one glass of wine as severely as if she had committed adultery. Pliny relates that a certain noble matron, who in obedience to her physician's orders, took a small quantity of wine, was deprived of her dowry by the judge, Onius Dominius, because she slightly exceeded the exact quantity that was necessary for her. Menzenius once caught his wife in the act of drinking wine, and he was so enraged thereat that he beat her to death. And not only did he go unpunished for his act, but he was even praised for it. More than that, Fabius Pictor writes of a noble lady was once condemned to be starved to death for merely opening the chest in which the keys of the wine cellar were kept. So abominable in the eyes of heathens was not merely actual drunkenness, but even the bare suspicion of it on the part of a woman. Christian women, I cannot, nor is it my intention, to forbid you to drink wine. I know well that the law of those ancient people was much too severe, and their anxiety to prevent drunkenness amongst women too great. But if you are determined to enjoy the good things that God has given you, do so in God's name, without forgetting the temperance that becomes a Christian woman. My only object is to show that all, men and women, who exceed in the use of intoxicating drinks, destroy their health, ruin their families, and bring disgrace upon themselves. What folly, what wickedness that is! Pardon me, my dear brethren, for having said so much of this shameful vice to you. Perhaps, and God grant that it may be the case, among all who are here present, there may be hardly one who requires admonition or warning on this point. At least my opinion is that they who are most guilty do not often come to hear a sermon. But my wish is to deter all from this shameful habit by bringing forward natural reasons to induce them to avoid it, which are often far more cogent than supernatural ones. They are the same reasons that you, who are masters and mistresses of families, often adduce, with threats and punishments in addition, to deter your servants, your relatives and acquaintances, especially when the latter are married, and your children also, from indulging in drunkenness. But you must never forget to enforce by your own example what you preach by words. I conclude with the warning of St. Peter, the Prince of the Apostles, in his first epistle, a warning that we read daily in the Divine Office. Be sober and watch, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, goeth about seeking whom he may devour. Therefore, be on your guard, all of you, and let your reason keep awake. Prudent and foreseeing parents, whose sons are away at college, do not give them all at once the money they require for the year, but send it to them every month, little by little, so that they may not be tempted to squander it away all at once, and then have to suffer want afterwards. It is the same with those bodies of ours that we have to support. If the salvation of our souls is not a sufficient motive for us to avoid drunkenness, let us, at least, if we are wise, give the necessary reflection to our bodies in such a way that our incomes will not suffer from it, and that we may always be able to do our duty to ourselves and to those belonging to us. Prudent parents, no matter how rich they are, never send their sons more than the latter are actually in need of, lest they become spendthrifts and bring disgrace on the family. It is so, I repeat, with these bodies of ours. If the salvation of our souls is not a sufficient motive to keep us from excessive drinking, let us at least consider our honor and good name and not take more than is good for our reputation. And still, these should be the least motives to induce us to practice temperance and sobriety. Transitory goods, empty honor, it is not for your sake that I wish to practice virtue. Thou, O God, to whom all love and honor are due, Thou hast commanded us to provide for our families as well as we can in temporal things, and to keep up our good name for the general edification of all. And therefore, to lead a sober and temperate life as becomes Christians. This we will do for thy sake, and with thy grace. Amen.